Well, why don't we get started? It's actually my pleasure to introduce a good friend of mine, Colleague Talbot, who's doing really good work in theology, specifically theology and economics.
Got a question for a moment?
Yes, it is.
Well,
thanks for that, sir. Specifically, I was saying theology and economics. He's obviously gone through the MDiv course at Talbot, which is your standard course for pastoral training. He's also in the THM program, which is more academic theological program. And he'll share a few more things about his background, but he's getting ready for a possible PhD program in theology as well. Eddie can share more, but his background is both in theology and economics. He's actually worked at a private equity firm that did some work in investment banking, so he knows that world really well, but he's also a theologian at heart. Folks might look at him and say, oh, is that possible? Because, he looks quite young. But don't let the Asian genes fool you guys. He remains, so he's actually 72. got some years on him. But, didn't expect that reaction, but okay. It's a privilege for me to share this lecture with Eddie. So he'll come on up and then share a few things, and then I'll also come back up and share a few things myself that are from the notes that you do have, and then we'll have Q&A after that. So before we do that, can you just pray for us, and then I'll invite Eddie. Father, we thank you once again for this opportunity to come together and to get into your word and to observe things there, as well as to observe things in the world and see where your truth is. And so help us to learn, Lord, as we reason, as we study your word, and also just think carefully together through these issues about the doctrine of the fall. Maybe things that we learn that truly do make a difference in our lives and the lives of those around us. And again, we thank you for this opportunity, Lord. This is an opportunity that not many people have around the world, and so may we truly cherish it and help us to have ownership over the things that we do learn tonight. Be with our brother Eddie as he shares your truth and your spirit behind us now. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so being healthy, welcome.
Well, the number is there's not a 3 in front, unfortunately. So I'm still in my 20s. Well, thank you, Dr. Park. Dr. Park and I are really good friends, recent friends actually. But he has given a lot and poured out into my life. He's a really good friend, brother, mentor, and I just think he's one of the most brilliant guys I've ever come across and met. And we're actually potentially doing a book project together, writing a book potentially on the theology of money, sex, and power. He does a lot of work in political theory, and I have done some work in economics, so we're really excited about writing that book together. So thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a huge opportunity to be here. I wanted to do a little introduction because just as I might look young, I might sound young, I might act young, and even my presentation might be a little childish, but I want to make sure that you guys know a little bit of my background, that I am qualified to teach this area. So a little bit of my CV. I did go to UCLA. My BA and my bachelor was in economics. I was an honors student there. And then after my degree in economics, I went and worked into the field of investment banking and private equity. Back in 06 and 07, that was really the hot field in economics. People were kind of making millions of dollars hand over foot, and my father, or my parents, I should say, as good Asian parents, would push me into this direction. So I worked in investment banking, private equity, but the Lord had a strong call on my heart. When I was 15 years old, I received a call to the pastorate, and it was unshakable, and it was something I really struggled with. And the Lord just kept on pressing that upon me when I was in college, and also when I was working and doing in school, and there was just a point where, I couldn't disobey anymore. I had to really make that first step, and I enrolled into seminary at night, part time, and I started at Fuller, and actually the Lord, I really struggled when I was at Fuller, but the Lord, during that dark season, He called me, and I ended up going to Talbot full-time, and it was one of the best experiences of my life. Just like I shared, I'm from Talbot Seminary. I just graduated my MDiv. I'm in my THM program now, doing work in theology, and specifically the area of theology of work. And so if anyone is interested in that area, we can have a discussion. Currently in ministry, I used to be just a general pastor in an immigrant church, a Korean-American church, but right now I recently just started my position at EV Free Fullerton, First Evangelical Free Fullerton. If you know the famous radio preacher Chuck Swindoll, that's the church that he originated from. And I'm currently serving under Senior Pastor Mike Erie, who used to be the Senior Pastor of Rock Harbor and Mariners Church, but he's currently the Senior Pastor EV Free Fullerton, and I serve as to be trained as an executive pastor there. And so that's kind of my ministry background, where I'm at. So if you have questions about what is that and what is an executive pastor, I wouldn't know much, but you can ask me and we can have a conversation about that. Just as Dr. Park kind of revealed, it does look like I probably won't finish my THM because I've been provisionally accepted to the University of Aberdeen to do my doctoral studies in systematic theology, again, in the area of theology of work. If you're interested in my dissertation or area of work will be a theology of wealth creation, or theology of money, innovation, and creativity, with special emphasis in the primitive Genesis narratives. So basically Genesis 1 to 11, and how that really structures an ethical framework to how to view society, specifically economics, the view of wealth, innovation, and creativity. So if you have questions about that, we can have a conversation after this as well. I want to share a little about my family, because I have a beautiful family, and I just can't go anywhere without showing off how beautiful my family is. This is my wife, Eunice. I call her my HH, my hot and holy wife. If you look at my phone, literally it does say hot wife. Or actually now it says hot mom, because we had our first child. His name is Haddon Timothy. This is him. He's about 3.5 months old. Cutie, but he's a handful for us. It's actually, if I drop dead in the middle of my lecture, please forgive me. I'm gonna have to ask Dr. Park to come up and kind of take care of the rest of the lecture, because my wife and I, we just don't get any sleep. And if you're parents, you probably know what that's like. Our son, you can see he's a little, these are not photoshopped in. These are actual rolls. That's actual shadows and space between his arms, because my son eats every hour and a half. Yeah, that's right. He eats every hour and a half, so my wife and I don't get much sleep. And it's been difficult because sometimes, you know, things will be so hectic in the morning, and I'd rush out the door trying to head to church, the church office, and I go through this dilemma. I don't know if you guys go through this dilemma, but on my way to church, there's a Starbucks, and I have about 5 minutes, a 5-minute margin to get to church or go to Starbucks. And I'll always kind of detour and go to Starbucks. And then I'll park my car, and then I'll get out of my car. My car doesn't have any tint on it. And then I always have this moment. I don't know if you ever have this moment, but I leave my car. I'm about to rush to get some coffee, but then I see my laptop is right in the back seat. And then I go through another dilemma. Do I go back and put my laptop in the trunk? And I almost always do it. I almost always do it. And so that pushes back my time from 5 minutes dwindling down to maybe a minute or two margin. But I always do that. I always have that moment where I rush out my car, I see my laptop bag, and I'm so compelled to put my laptop in the trunk. And why is that? Why do we have that tension? Why do we, even before I came into the door here, Dr. Park said, did you lock your car? And I was like, oh yeah. Gotta lock my car. We're in Irvine still, but I still gotta lock my car. So I locked it. Why do we go to that? Why do we go to those daily ethical decisions? Well, yeah, because evil exists in the world. You can't trust society, people. The human volition is corrupted. And that's exactly the topic that we're gonna go to today, the fall, the doctrine of the fall. Why is the fall so important to study? We can probably list off a numerous amount of reasons, but why I study the fall, and from what I know that this course is, the main question that's driving this course is, how do these doctrines inform us, inform our framework, our philosophy, and how to impact culture? Am I correct? Has that been the driving question for every lecture, every topic? How does what this cognitive, theoretical information and content, how does it inform us to actually impact society? How does it actually drive us to love our neighbor, to have conviction, to speak out against evil, to do the right thing when no one is doing the right thing? Well, why the doctrine of the fall? Well, a few reasons. It really enhances our evangelism. It's not too popular these days to go up to someone on a college campus and say, "Do you know Jesus? Are you saved? Do you know the Lord?" It's not too popular or effective these days, but as you meet with someone and have a conversation, and if you can get to a personal level with someone, most likely someone will reveal and share their area of pain, their area of suffering. And that is a place where we can really leverage and speak in. Why that is? Because no philosophy, no religious system really can answer that question. Why is there pain and suffering in this world? And that's where you can jump in. For those who are trained in apologetics and if just have a heart for evangelism, that's where really you can discuss the nature and the doctrine of the fall to that person and to explain to them maybe the first few phases of the gospel. Why else is it helpful? Well, culture, if we look at culture, it's eroding. Can we all agree upon that? Culture in itself is becoming more and more tolerant of evil, right? I'm trying to diet. I'm trying to cut down on my sweets. But when I go down the aisle of the chips and cookies, you know what really sticks out to me the most? Is the bag that says sinful. Right? The cookie, the big chocolate chip, sinfully decadent. Right? And it's fascinating that we live in a society where if something is plastered with their name, with the word sin on it, or devil, it's a good thing, right? Our society says it's an intrinsically good thing to be sinful and to have the word devil in it because it means that it's desirable, that it's delicious, that it's just so good. Right? And this, we can see that our culture is shifting that way. So the way we view culture, it's so important that we really examine. That's why the nature of my presentation is a microscope, because we're going to examine the doctrine of the fall. And why else is the doctrine of the fall so important to impacting culture is because it is actually one of the core tenets and key components of the gospel message. Last time I checked, the four spiritual laws is still one of the most effective ways to share the gospel with someone. If you ever have done missions in overseas, in India or China, people are still using the four spiritual laws because it is, it's just a very composed and tight and concise way to explain the biblical narrative of the history of mankind. And so we always start with the doctrine of creation or man, and then immediately things go really bad and we talk about the fall. And so we have to really dig deep and have a very nuanced and complex way of explaining and conveying the doctrine of the fall. Not just you're sinful, the world is evil, but can we in that, because you know, when you're evangelizing something, right, you're just so quick to get to Jesus. Yeah, things are bad, but hey, but Jesus can save you, right? Jesus sent his only one and son to save your soul. The cross has overturned all that. And we're so excited. We can't wait to share about Jesus. But sometimes it's more helpful to stay with the problem of evil, with the problem of pain and suffering, with the problem of racism, with the problem of poverty. Sometimes it's more beneficial to our evangelism and to our apologetics to stay in that arena of the gospel narrative, because that's where people have the most questions, and that's where we can give the best answers. So that's kind of my take on why the study of the doctrine of the fall examining this doctrine is so helpful and so crucial. Primarily, we can't hit all the topics of the doctrine of fall, but there's one key topic that I do want to take to convey. It's the distinction between the total depravity and total inability. And when we think of the fall or the curse, we have this theological category of total depravity. And what's the first thing you think about when you think of total depravity? Death. Right, the recent killing, murder. When we think of total depravity, did you have something?
No.
Well, total depravity, yes? Yeah, I mean, there's no wrong answers right now. Right. Yeah. Lack of any morals, right. Depravity. Well, for me, when I think of total depravity or I think of total sin, I think of the first letter in a very famous theological system. Have you ever heard of TULIP? Has anyone heard of TULIP? Right. Calvinism, right? Bold Calvinist in this room? No. All right. I knew that would be one. When we usually think of total depravity as the T in TULIP. And that's actually kind of, a lot of people think of it that way. We think of the total depravity, that phrase, soteriologically. And so when we think of depravity, we think of murder, we think of sinfulness, we most likely refer to the corruption of mankind, right? The corruption, the perversion of the human volition, right? Disobeyed God, we're corrupt, we're depraved, we're sinful, no man can do good on his own. Say that again? Distortion of the truth. Very good. Yeah. And man doesn't even know how to even see what the truth is. They can't even possibly know what good is, true good is. There is no truth. Right. Wow, some postmodernists in here. Yeah. We normally think of corruption of mankind. So this is actually the key pivot in our session tonight. We kind of have to be all on the same page. You don't have to agree per se, but we all have to be on the same page in order to progress forward into this lecture or discussion, because we have to kind of move out of our category. The doctrine of sin is focused on the corruption of mankind, the perversion of the human volition. Mankind is evil, they're wicked, and which is true. But in order to create and build a helpful framework to impact society, right? Because that's the driving question of this course. How do we build a theology? How do we build a framework how these doctrines inform us to impact society, to actually transform society? Were some of you here for the first lecture that Dr. Park lectured on? Yes. He described three positions or three views on a Christian worldview, right? Between how to view Christian truth and society. Can anyone kind of recall what the titles, what he termed those three positions? Right. Isolation is the first view. Can anyone give a summary of what the isolation view actually entails? Sure. Yeah. I think it's... If you can't beat them, leave them. Is that correct? Okay. I think the way that he put it in his lecture is actually really brilliant. In the Christian, maybe academic world, they kind of categorize it with five positions. I think he did a really good job by just kind of narrowing it down to three positions. Yeah, but the first is the isolation view, which is actually what we're more comfortable with, right? It actually originated from Martin Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms, right? So when when the Reformation happened, that there's this distinction between what is sacred and what is secular. And more or less, we're pretty aware of that position, right? On the extreme end, that position could look like very Quaker, very Amish, against society. That says a lot that you think that view is being judgmental, because a lot of fundamentalists and conservative evangelicals would say that is actually the right and biblical position to hold, to separate and to be the wheat from the chaff, in a sense. Yeah, it's a doctrine of separation. That's exactly right. Not to separate completely from the world. To not have fellowship with them? To have fellowship, yeah. Right. Well, that's progress. That's good. Because this whole course is about how to construct a worldview where we can actually impact culture. But if you fall into the camp of isolation, then you're going to want nothing to do with culture. You're going to think rap music is bad. You're going to want to think that fashion is bad. All type of commercialism is evil. I don't see many Apple products, but Apple is the mark of the beast in this position, right? That's the first position. The second position is what again? The accommodation view. This is pretty much the opposite view of the isolation view. Can anyone summarize in their own words what the accommodation view is? To fit the culture. That's a great way to put it. Again, I want to give credit to Dr. Park. He does a great job in conveying that. Yes? Yeah. But was that in your own words, or was that what Dr. Park put? The accommodation view is this position where you would see a lot of relevancy, you know, trying to bring culture and not viewing it as a bad thing, but just view it's a little bit more postmodern that way, where it's just, you know, culture is this evolving organism. It's a little deistic, where like culture is a part of who God is too, and it evolves, and we have to accommodate it. Kind of the more extreme view of the accommodation view is where liberals and neoliberals will take it to the extreme. That's where we see the emergent church, simple church, where kind of anything goes, really, when it comes to being spiritual. Well, lastly, and I think is the most helpful view, is the last view, which is the transformational view. It's kind of a view that is best of both worlds. It's a view that is that takes the strength of the isolation view, that takes the biblical truth. A special revelation that's revealed in our sacred text as true. And it takes the best of the world of the accommodation view, where they say that science and philosophy and the academic disciplines, they're also true and also helpful, but we don't view them above the special revelation. And so we kind of use both in order to transform society and impact society, because that's actually the view, that's actually the part of the gospel narrative, to redeem creation and to renew it. So yeah, I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page in case some people missed that, because that's pretty crucial to this lecture. Again, going back to depravity, very, very crucial pivot. I want us to kind of expand the category of the doctrine of the fall just from thinking about the corruption of the human will. Because actually, when we think about depravity and we think about the doctrine of fall, most likely you're thinking about the doctrine of total inability. Total inability is a doctrine that says no human can change their condition to be saved on their own. That's really what the doctrine is. And this doctrine of total inability is at the individual level, and is usually discussed in the context of soteriology, the doctrine of salvation, how we become saved. And so I kind of want us to kind of see a distinction between when we think of total depravity, because when we think of the doctrine of the fall, kind of the next step we talk about, or the next theological term we talk about, is total depravity. But I want us to kind of get a real definition of what total depravity is, because at the popular level, we think of it really as total inability, this the human will being unable to correct themselves in order to have a right relationship with God. That's true, but that's only one dimension of the doctrine of the fall, among many others. And that's kind of what I want us to really discuss and talk about today. So when we think of total depravity, a more helpful way to describe it, I would say, is total depravity is actually more cosmic. It's discussing more at a universal level, more than just the individual human soul, and not just talking about soteriology, how we become saved. Because inability is talking about, can I save myself through my good works? Can I save myself through religion? Can I save myself through some existential experience? Right? You are incapable, exactly. And so when we talk about the fall, what's more helpful is to expand our doctrine of the fall out of just thinking soteriologically and individually, but thinking cosmically. The doctrine of the fall has affected not just the human soul, my soul, your soul, but has affected the cosmic universe, all created order. Any questions so far? Can you reword that question again? Sorry.
Right. So, take a case study, like the first fall, the sin of Adam and Eve, how their depravity and inability come.
That, I'm so glad you asked that question, because that's a natural segue to the next point. So yeah, let's go to the biblical text and let's see what you're talking about. Can we see from the biblical text the narrative of Adam and Eve? Can we see the distinction between inability and depravity? And my answer to this, yes, we can. Let's look at the text. Kind of sick of hearing myself talk. Can someone read our text for today from Genesis 3? Anyone, right? Yeah. Yeah, just one up there. I think it's about verse 3, yeah. The whole passage is fine. Right. So we're all familiar with this. This is how sin entered the cosmos, the created order. If we remember from Genesis 1, right, God said, it is good. It's actually very good on the last day. And as he rested on the seventh day, he was pleased with the work that he did. He was happy. It was good. And he started giving orders and commands to mankind as his vice regents, his vice, as co-heirs, and to rule and have dominion over all created order. But God did one thing. God couldn't give a being that is made in his own image, that has every capacity and every power to rule and to have dominion, without limiting the creation. Because without limiting the creator, the creature, then there will be nothing in the creature to say, well, I'm the same as God. And if we could have a little bit more liberty to think about the biblical narrative, God kind of already knows what happens when he gives a little bit of arrogance to a creature, right? He gave a little bit of confidence and no limitation to a creature, an angelic figure. And that person thought, you're not better than me. And that creature rose up against the creator. So God, he's pretty smart. He knows what to do the second time around, right? So in this creature, who he makes in his own image, again, we're having a little liberty with this, with the narrative. He limits the creature and he says, well, okay, you can do everything that I can do. You can eat. You can have dominion. You can even name the animals. I named you. So you know what? You name all the rest of the creatures. But God knows there has to be some limitation to what you can do, or else what will make you think that you're any different from me? And so he does one thing. He says, don't eat just from that tree. Just that one. Just don't do that one. He limits the creature. And there we see is the room for sin and corruption to enter into the cosmos. And so we know this story very well. The woman goes to the tree, and the serpent very cunningly says, did he really say you'll die? And you know the funny thing is about that story? You know, I used to be a children's pastor. I did children's ministry, and I gave the story, right? And I told the story about Genesis 3. And one of my first grade students, they said, but they didn't die after he ate it, right? And then I was kind of stuck. I was like, yeah, but, you know, it's like, it's not that kind of death. It's like spiritual death. But God said they're going to die. You know, like, he kept on pushing that up against that. And I was like, oh, he's right. You're absolutely right. They did eat the apple, and they didn't die right away. And I'm trying to explain, well, it's like metaphysical, and it's a metaphor, little first grader. You don't understand, right? But it got me really thinking, and that's kind of the thinking that really caused me to create this lecture. And so let's really, what will be helpful, moving out of our view of total depravity or total inability in a more cosmic, universal view of the doctrine, in order to impact society, is to really see the extent of the fall. And the extent of the fall has multi-dimensions. And these are the multi-dimensions of the fall. Spiritual, it's kind of what we're familiar with. There is a spiritual dimension of the fall. There's disconnection and separation from God the Father and His creature. There's a physical aspect of the fall, where there is death. Things wither and die. We have physical ailments and sickness and hurt. We bleed. Relational. We can see from this biblical narrative that there is a relational dimension of the fall that has happened between Adam and his wife. Ecological. Have you ever thought about that? That there's an ecological dimension of the fall. That the earth is suffering because of what Adam has done. That God didn't originally create the earth to have flash floods and tsunamis and earthquakes and volcano eruptions. Economic, this is the area that I kind of emphasize in, that work was never meant to be painful. That making money was actually a part of our, you know, producing and creating and working and keeping. That's actually part of our ontology, and it was supposed to be good. God Himself created the cosmos. It's a part of who He is. But why is it so hard to get up in the morning and to go to the office? And why do we have poverty? Why in a world where we have enough resources and food to feed the whole world, is there poverty and children dying of starvation? There's an economic dimension to the fall. And lastly, there's a psychological, metaphysical dimension to the fall. I don't think mankind was meant to be depressed, have clinical anxiety, bipolar disorder. There are dimensions of the fall that really affect our psyche and even the way we view ourselves, the person we stare at in the mirror. So we're going to see these verses, actually. We're going to see how, you know, just as you pointedly asked, how can we see the distinction between total inability and total depravity? Yes, we can. And so let's look at spiritual. Spiritual, we'll see, right as we see in Genesis, right, they hear the sound of the Lord walking in the garden, the coolness of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord. Right? Why would they hide? Well, the Lord called out to the man and said, where are you? And he said, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. So we already see that there is a spiritual disconnect between the Creator and the creature. That God, somehow the intimacy and the trust and love was broken somehow. And we can all attest to that. That there is a disconnection, a separation between God who's meant to be the most intimate, most important being in our lives, but now we're afraid of him. We fear God. We feel naked before him. We feel ashamed of our sin. There's a spiritual aspect. And you hide, exactly. Physical. The physical dimension of the fall. This is one of my wife's favorite verses. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you will bring forth children. Now to think, if they didn't choose to disobey God, that there would be no pain in childbirth. I wonder what every mother in this room is shaking their fist at the first woman. Why? We never would have to go through that pain. Right? There's physical pain in the world now. And it's ironic, and I think it's very intentional of God to bring the most pain and suffering into the most meaningful experience of being a woman, actually. The act of giving life, nurturing a baby, bringing forth children. It's something that I, as a man, will never experience. And in that moment, he brings most pain. Relational dimension of the fall. Do we see it in the narrative? Yes, we do. When the woman saw the tree was good for food and it was a delight to his eyes and the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from it its fruit and ate, and then she gave it to her husband. And then what happened? The eyes of both of them were opened. What happened? They knew that they were naked. So something in that moment, this narrative tells us that there was a disconnect between gender and sex. That the minute that they fell and disobeyed God, they looked at each other and they said, what? Whoa, you have different parts than I do. You're different than me. But it's interesting that before that they ate, they were naked. And that they didn't see any distinction between themselves. And in the chapter right previous to it, the chapter ends with what? To become one flesh. Man and woman. They were never meant to see themselves as different. They're always meant to see themselves as human. But the nature of the fall says, whoa, you're different. You're not like me. The man says, I'm above you. Yes, comment. Let's read on then to see. The man said to the woman whom, so the first thing the man does in verse 12 when God points to him like, hey, you messed up. What does he do? It's like, well, the woman you gave me. Right? Right. Blame shifts, to his partner, meant to be his equal. So he doesn't say like, well, you know, we're a team, God. You know? No, he puts the blame on the other creature. Maybe we could see a little bit more. Verse 16, the woman said, I will surely, or to the woman he said, I will surely make the pain. And then what else is the curse to the woman? Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Again, we see that there is a relational crack in the way it's meant to be. I'm not saying it's meant to be like this, or he's not stripping distinction and the complement of women and male and female. But what I'm saying is there was a relational aspect of them being one, of them being mutually understanding, but there's something cracked where they view the person distrustingly, suspiciously. I don't know. Those who are married, you know, I'm sure you guys have perfect marriages, never fight, so. maybe not.
So you only two chapters before the fall.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of data after fall.
But yeah.
Before that, we have a couple of chapters, so we don't have too many data.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's so, true.
But so the two chapters are sufficient for you to make that argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are some 5 points that you put that in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
After you put all the 5 points, is that all the two chapters that are sufficient to justify you at 5 points?
No? You're saying that, I see what you're saying. So is it accurate of me to say that before the fall that there was no relational...
There are some 5 points that you put at the beginning of this SEC for this.
Uh-huh.
So those are big words. If you want to justify that, so the couple of chapters at the beginning of the fall, is that sufficient for you to...
I'm not sure exactly what... Oh, you're saying, so these you're saying.
Right.
Right.
This chapter, there's a big change between
mm-hmm.
But in order to make this 5-6 things, you have 1188 chapters after fall, a lot of data.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you only a couple of chapters.
Yeah, that's a very engineering way to view it. But you know what you're really asking is that the opposite of what you're saying is that things were imperfect before the fall is actually the implication.
I think that things were imperfect after fall. All
yeah.
Kind of
yeah, happening. Yeah.
But how do you testify before fall? We have sufficient...
Sure. I mean, I can't really go into all that. I mean, I can go through like Talmud and rabbinic texts and Second Temple and like rabbinic exegesis and then church father exegesis and Lutheran theologians and how they build upon Genesis and the primitive narrative. I could go through all that. I'm just not sure if everybody wants me to go through all that. Yeah. But there is a basis, though.
I mean, what are the questions he asked? Probably kind of subset.
Sure. I wasn't really prepared. I didn't know that this would be a graduate level, maybe pre-doctorate class. Next time I'll come with my rabbinic, you know, my encyclopedias and references. And yeah, I wasn't really sure what this, yeah, I'll bring the HD versions of like the text, and we can do the textual criticism, and we can break down the Hebrew and the Akkadian. We can do that, but. Oh, thank you. Yeah, just to say, I know, you know, it's right for you to have certain distrust because you don't know me, you don't know my background. And it's just, I guess face value is there is certain basis to these conclusions. That's all I can really say.
Maybe also Dr. John, maybe asking your question, which is often asked in general, but which is, so minimal quantity of text, and it justifies such significant quality of this, right? So the big quantity.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, yeah, I guess a way to...
Actually, my simple question is, she actually pointed out a small subset of it. I kind of generalized it.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure, think of it this way. Did you have a comment? I don't want to cut you off. Yeah. Yes. 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 Right. That's a good observation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes. Right. And I don't want to not address your question. Think of it this way. You're second generation Israel. It's, you know, you're at the brink of the Jordan. It's about maybe 1400 BC. Moses is leading you. And you're like, hey, I'm bored. I want to read our library. There's probably none. Moses is still writing, you know, the Torah. but there's oral tradition, right, of the elders of the tribes of Israel. And they're like, hey, I'm bored. We're just stuck in the desert. I don't know why we can't cross the Jordan. Like, can you just tell me, you know, the narrative of the patriarchs and whatnot? It's like, yeah, in the beginning, you know, like they're going through the syncopation of the song. They actually sing the text in Hebrew, and they're listening to it. And you have to understand that there wasn't much text outside of Torah and maybe the story of Job and maybe other rabbinic text or texts that kind of they could draw ethical principles from for life, for society. There wasn't much. So everything that they're drawing from, their worldview, came from these texts. It wasn't just about, you know, we kind of view it as just theology proper about God. They're drawing every sort of principle. How do I treat my wife? How do I treat my children? How do I draw water from the river? How do I slaughter my lamb? They're drawing every single life principle from these texts. And it's not very extensive. For us, we have access to the Library of Congress, right? But for them, it was expanding. And as time grows and there's more text and more knowledge and more things written, it's more nuanced. And that's what you're saying, there's more data. But I think it's pretty safe to say that all life kind of stemmed from these core texts, even the first two chapters. And think of it. How many times have you read Ezekiel, and how many times have you read Genesis? I think it's about 100-1 for me. I'm not sure about you. I always say, I'm going to start reading the Bible. I'm going to start in Genesis, and then you get to chapter 30, you know, say, you know, I did well. I pat myself on the back, you know. So, yeah, there's an aspect of that, too. They probably know the first two chapters of Genesis pretty darn well, and they're probably drawing a lot of their life principles from that. So, I don't know if that's helpful. I'm open to discussing this after, but I do want to address your concern, because it is a legitimate concern. I could see that how it's, that's a stumbling block. Can we move on? My favorite is economics, and you guys are kind of keeping me from it. Economics. It's nature. Oh, ecological. Sorry, ecological, yes. There's an ecological dimension that has been corrupted, right? Have you ever thought that the relationship between humans and animals, the lower creatures, has been distorted, right? We were called to have dominion over them. We're supposed to have reign. But what happens? Man actually listens to the creature. Though your cat rules over me, right? That it's not meant to be that way, right? And we see that in the narrative. We see that God curses the woman and the serpent and says, I will put enmity between you. You have to understand, we can read this Christocentrically as Christian scripture because we know how the story ends. Oh, he's talking about Jesus here. You know, he's going to, you know, beat Satan in the end. But you have to understand that in the desert, ancient Israel, ancient Near East, they're reading this as like, oh, that's why that tiger ate my uncle, right? They're thinking that way. They're thinking, oh, why do... You know, I thought we were meant to, you know, Papa, I thought we were meant to reign over the bears. How come they keep killing our people, right? They're reading texts like this and say, there's a distortion in ecology with animals, between animals and mankind. We're supposed to rule over them. They're supposed to fear us, but that's not happening. Again, ecology. The ground is in pain because of what Adam has done. Because you listen to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree which I have commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Cursed is the ground. The ground is in pain. The earth is suffering. Ecological dimension of the fall. Economic dimension of the fall. We talked about work. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. No longer will you have joy like I had joy in it. But it will be hard. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread. It will be hard. It will be painful. Till you return to the ground. Till the day we die, guys. Work's going to be tough. Making money, putting food on the table is going to be tough. And psychological, metaphysical. I know we're running a little long on time, but even the way we view ourselves, brothers and sisters, has been distorted. Right? We're living in an age where, you know, we're the selfie generation. I don't know if you have kids, but we're constantly taking pictures of themselves, taking pictures of the food. There's a pervasive emptiness in the meaning of life.
Going back to that, so the fall, if I come back to
Did we lose dominion? That's a good... Well, I don't think it's the way it is right now. I mean, just like as the sister kind of pointed out, like, I know you have... Yeah, you can't do that. Yeah. Yes, we are. Yeah. It's more challenging, exactly. Yeah. No, good question. I had to process through that as you asked that. Oh, I never thought about that. But yeah, psychological, metaphysical, there's a distortion. My father, he has clinical anxiety, and he's a pill popper. He takes every pill, you know, he had to take lithium. And actually, unfortunately, he actually passed it on to me. When I was in high school and college, I would get so stressed and hyperventilate, and I'd pass out after by having panic attacks. It's actually the same type of panic attacks that my father has. But you know, in Christ, the name of Jesus can heal, and really, just simply said, just fix those things. Not all the time, but for my case, I haven't had one. So after I really gave my life to the Lord, those are discontinued. But I know it's not the case for a lot of people. But anyway, key takeaways. I know I'm rushing through this, but I want to give Dr. Park at least a little bit of platform to speak. Key takeaways. The fall is an essential component of the gospel, right? If we think of it as a traditional four spiritual laws, man, fall, redemption, consummation, the fall is a key essential component of how we view, or how we convey the gospel and how we build a biblical worldview. And if we agree to that, and we have just learned that the extent of the fall isn't just single dimensional to the individual soul or the corruption of the human individual, but it's actually multidimensional. All facets of human life, all creation has been affected by the fall. Therefore, in order to construct a Christian worldview, in order to take the doctrine of the fall and how to inform us to impact culture, is this. Thus, the gospel, by the logic of the doctrines of creation and the fall, has every implication for every dimension of human life. My sister-in-law is a graphic designer, and I don't want her to think that being a graphic designer has nothing to do with the gospel. I sit down with her over dinner, and I say, no, what you do, your field of design and aesthetic and beauty, creating websites, interaction, that has everything to do with the gospel, actually. The gospel has every implication to that. How it works out, that's the role of a theologian, to really figure that out. How to process that. My cousin, he's an accountant. Does it have to do with the gospel? It has every implication of the gospel. We cannot, if you're a mother, if you work in construction, if you even PetSmart, you know, animals, every facet of human life has been affected by the fall. And the gospel, the person and work of Jesus Christ, has every relevance to that area. Because we confess Him as Savior and Lord. Amen? He's Lord of every square inch of creation. And all the earth, He says, is mine. If every dimension of human life has been corrupted, there's a need and call for redemption. Human flourishing. So my friends, I just hope that our time has really helped kind of open your worldview to see that every single dimension of human life has been affected by the fall. And there's a need and calling. If you are a child of God, and as the people of God, there's a calling for redemption there. And to say, no, this fear has every implication of the gospel, and it needs our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Then he's across the street. It has everything to do with the gospel. Right? Your car salesman, he has everything to do with the gospel. It's to build a biblical worldview to say the gospel impacts every single inch of created order in creation. Well, thank you very much. My time is probably up, and I'm going to invite Dr. Park to come up for his lecture.
So I think what Eddie Park has done for us is really two things. One, given us a great overview and an account for us as Christian thinkers to tell that same sort of very compelling narrative about this aspect of our theology to those around us. So, you know, for example, he shared a story about his father and how we, from a Christian worldview perspective, can account for clinical anxiety. I think it's a much more compelling narrative that we can use to talk to people about it. Now, of course, you know, we might say, well, the atheists can tell a story too about it, like it's just all neurological and it's DNA related and so on and so forth. Yeah, they can. But that, I think, has a deeply missing component of the human aspect of that issue, right? And so what I'm saying is it's actually a rather compelling narrative, and we are to use our compelling narratives and when we do our apologetics. Right, yeah, yeah. Because theirs is just purely naturalistic. Like, here's what it is. We're not saying that it's good or bad. There's no evaluative dimension. It's just, here's the science. But ours is much more... That's right. That's right. Yeah. So I think that's what he's done. He's kind of given us this account, this compelling narrative to understand the doctrine of the fall. And then the second thing, as I was mentioning, that I think he did is set up the next lecture that we'll have together on the issue of redemption, right? The doctrine of redemption. Why is it then, if we know that the gospel has implications for all these areas which have been affected by the fall, now we're called to be in the business of redemption with God. So that will be quite literally in 2 weeks' time. As you all know, next week, Jacob Daniel, whom I think a lot of you have met, you know, unlike me, you actually like him, so that's cool. he'll be here, and he'll share on kind of a summary, if you will, of a Christian worldview, and then we'll jump right back into redemption. What we're going to do for the remainder of our time is I'm going to try to unpack a little bit more. We'll have a break, and then we're going to try to use our time wisely. And I'm going to try to unpack a couple more things that I wanted to touch on. And that's going to, again, build that bridge over to redemption for 2 weeks' time. Okay, so why don't we then come back at 8:15. I think I can do it in 15 minutes. But we'll do that, and then we'll leave some time for Q&A after that as well. Okay, so we'll see you in about 6-7 minutes. All right, folks. Well, why don't we try to come back together and finish off really sort of two big points that I'd like to make in my part of the lecture tonight. And they're going to build off of everything Eddie just shared with us. And they're going to have a much more sociological dimension to it. And the reason, of course, is because ultimately we want to impact society. We want to impact culture. And so let's look at it sociologically then. All right. So there's a few things in your notes that we that you could read over. It's been actually expounded very well from Eddie's presentation. So actually much greater detail. So that you have with you. Theologians sometimes use this alliteration of some of the effects of the fall coming in the form of perversion, pollution, and punishment. There's this thing about punishment that I would often like to talk about, but for the sake of time, we're just going to have to kind of gloss over it. But if I think I have it in your notes, but remember where I quote C.S. Lewis, and he says, at first the Germans killed the Jews because they hated them. But later, because they killed them, they started hating them more. And so there's this interesting addiction to sin that's actually a punishment that we receive. A lot of times we think, oh, yeah, our addiction to sin is what caused the fall. Actually, the fall caused this addiction to sin, and it's illustrated well in Lewis's story about the Nazi German soldier during the Holocaust. There's something there to unpack as well. But yes, that's actually Mere Christianity. You wouldn't expect to find it in there, but it is. Yeah. There's a second thing I want to talk about, which is the specifically intellectual effect of the fall. Now, if you go back to the fancy subtitle of the lecture, you'll read this word called noetic distortion, and noetic just comes from the same Greek word that we get the word mind, nous, N-O-U-S.
The idea there is that our mind, our intellectual life, our ability to grasp, as Eddie and Fides were talking about, truth and goodness, that ability has been distorted, right? So not only do we misperceive truth, like, I didn't get what you just said, right? Like, we misperceive what truth could be. We also misrepresent it then to others, right? Now, we don't do this just with truth, right? So one of you tells me something that actually is true. I don't believe it because of my own prejudice, or I just don't get it. Like, I just intellectually can't grasp it, whatever. But then I take it from you and I distort it a little bit. I'm like, no, I think it's more like this. Then I take that falsity, that not real truth there, and then start, maybe on Facebook or wherever, right? I start representing it or present it again to others. And that's why we are in the place that we are. Truth is not as pristine or pure as it should be because of this noetic distortion. Okay, that's like kind of a fancy term for it. But like I said, it's not just truth. I know we as Christian apologists, we should always, perhaps we can say, start and end with truth. But there are other things that get distorted truth as well. Not just truth, but two other specific areas, which are beauty and goodness. Now, we're going to talk about all three of those. And if we sum it up, it's called the doctrine of the transcendentals. Way back before, when we were quite young, maybe before we were born, in about the 12th century, we were actually taught by a lot of our Christian theologians that there are three categories, okay? I know I'm going quite quickly here, but I'm hoping to grasp this. But don't worry. 2 weeks from now, we're going to unpack this at length, okay? But I want to just set it up so you have some of the framework. There are three categories that these theologians suggested transcend everything that we know. So right now, if I ask you, take 5 seconds to think of one thing. Just think of a thing. I mean, it literally could be any object, person, maybe idea, food, whatever. Think of something. Grab it and grab a hold of it in your mind. And let me make a bet here that the theologians, the medieval theologians would say, they would bet that whatever any one of us is thinking about is either going to fall on the category of goodness, or truth, or beauty, right?
I don't know about that. I said I thought
it was a balloon. A balloon? No, this is good. And we'll unpack this. Now, let me do two quick caveats, right? One is, there's overlap, right? So for example, let's start with a sentence. A sentence could be true or false. It could also be beautiful or not so beautiful, right? There's going to be overlap. Okay, I'll grant that. The second thing is to note that there is also called gradations, right? So while, I don't know, a particular rose might be quite beautiful, another one might be beautiful but not as beautiful. So there's gradations of beauty, okay? Now, a balloon, yeah. A balloon could easily think of a balloon that's pretty darn, they can make nice animals out of balloons or whatever, right? The beauty of that art of creating for a child a balloon. Versus like, oh, he tried, but man, get a day job, right? Like, that didn't work, okay? So yeah, I mean, it's crazy though. Think of anything, a balloon, a pizza box, or what have you. You're gonna, I see Jet's hand, which is gonna tell me, there's a third caveat really, there are exceptions to this, there are very few, but some of you will hit on it, and that's actually quite brilliant if you do. But there are exceptions to this, but let me just take Jeff's. There you go. Class dismissed. There you go. That's great. Yeah. So, but isn't it pretty ingenious of these medieval theologians to just kind of sit there, armchair their way to these truths, these conclusions, and say, you know what? Anything, just about anything we all think of will fall. Because that's why they called it the doctrine of the transcendentals. Goodness, truth, and beauty transcend all existing things, as it were, okay? We've already said that. That's just a fancy way of saying all of that. Now, very briefly, goodness, truth, and beauty again, or the GTBs, I like to refer to them as. Goodness, truth, and beauty, you've got, dogs can be good or bad. That's actually a dog I used to have that I affectionately named after someone whom I greatly admire. That's Piper there. Secondly is truth. You can have moral truths, like, killing innocent persons for fun is wrong. That's a moral truth. You can have mathematical truths. You guys get the idea. So there's goodness. There's truth as another category, and the third would be beauty, of which the most excellent example I could think of would be, of course, my own wife. I'm saying it's being recorded. That's the thing. You know what I'm saying? It's being recorded. All right. So what we're going to do, again, for the sake of time, and I promise you we will be hitting on this very much in detail in 2 weeks from now. And that's going to be of, so what does this mean for us? If it's true that the transcendentals do range over everything we know cosmically, right? If it ranges over the entire cosmos, if that's true, and if we know it's also true that our human nature has been impacted by the fall, as well as the rest of creation has been impacted by the fall, then wouldn't it be in the Christian Redeemer, the Christian who's in the business of redeeming with God, wouldn't it be in his or her best interest to bring about goodness, truth, and beauty wherever it can be found, right? The job of the Christian thinker, the job of the Christian, as we talk about analysts and activists, our job is to bring about or to redeem the goodness, truth, and beauty to be found in the world that has been either tainted or somewhat significantly lost, right? Because of the doctrine of the fall, we've got goodness, truth, and beauty having been denigrated, right? It's been impacted in a negative way. So our job would be to bring about, recover the goodness, truth, and beauty, redeem the goodness, truth, and beauty that we see in car sales to, you know, balloon making to movie making and all the rest, right? So that's our job, is to redeem the goodness, truth, and beauty to bring about the transcendentals. Again, we can pass over this quite well now because Eddie's help. Now, again, here's this last notion. I told you there's two big notions. One is transcendentals. Here's the other one. And then we'll take some Q&A. The second notion I want you to have in mind as we move into redemption is this. If we're going to go about and try to recover the goodness, truth, and beauty lost in our world, one very helpful notion to keep in mind comes from the whole branch of sociology, and the term is reification. I think we might have briefly mentioned this once in one of our lectures earlier. But the word there is literally, if you do it in the Latin, it's literally, that word can be translated as thingification. Yeah, right. And so one of the, you know, people ask, why do sociologists do that? Sorry? Thingification, like making into a thing, right? Yeah. Now the students here are interested, and I can bring this back to class and say, you know, tell their teachers, use that word in an essay. Like, no, it's a real word, you know, thingification, right? Here's why it's important, right? Reification just means to make into a thing. So I'm going to give you some examples. Think of a baseball. Think of the baseball game itself. Think of a building, of the White House. Think of politics as a whole. Think of Panera Bread. When you walk into Panera Bread, in all these instances, what's going on is a sociological concept called reification. I'll illustrate it very easily, right? There's a good reason why I wouldn't go here to the back of the room, sit next to Fides, and finish my lecture. Why? Answer? The audience, speaker, relationship has been reified. It's been made into a thing. So much that, oh my gosh, that's really weird. Why are you sitting over there, right? It's, you can't even imagine it being different, right? Now, at first when you hear this, it's like, yeah, that sounds right. But why is he making such a big deal out of it, right? Or you go to Panera Bread, you know, you're like, oh, you know, I like this blueberry bagel with that kind of cream cheese on it. In fact, I know exactly how I like it toasted, so let me just come over here and help myself. Like, you would never, because the customer-cashier relationship has been reified. You wouldn't run, after hitting the ball, to third, second, first, and back to home, because the game of baseball has been reified. You would never see a blue ribbon thread going through a baseball and still call it a baseball. It would just be weird to see that. Like, what? Maybe this is a special thing, like an Olympic thing. I don't know. You would think it's an odd sort of thing because the baseball has been reified. Okay? Now, you're just getting the notion of what it means to reify something. I'll give you my 50-cent definition of it real quick. To reify, from the res of Latin, literally just means to reify an object means to present. Again, this is all in your notes, and this is just kind of 50-cent words here. We'll get past the terms, but we need to get the ideas. To present a given human construction. What's that? A baseball or a building. Are you with me? These are given human constructions, right? Or a cultural phenomenon. What's that? The baseball game or politics. These are phenomena that's been created as a result of us living together, right? Okay, so to reify an object means to present a given baseball or cultural phenomena like politics as a bare fact or non-negotiable aspect of reality, right? What do we mean? I won't cross over from the carpet part to the tile part because that has been non-negotiable. I can't even think to pass over onto the tile part to help myself to a bagel. Are you guys following? So it's been made into such a non-negotiable aspect of reality. That's what reification does. That's why we actually have society. Then what happens next? In turn, we then perceive it as such. Oh yeah, like I would never go past that tile part. Right? We perceive it as such, and then we, in turn, represent it to others as such. Like, no, why would you ever think of crossing that, you know, tile part, right? I'm the cashier. You're the customer. Stay over there, please, right? You don't even have to say it because you're just, by participating in it, you're actually representing it every single time, okay? Now, you guys are thinking, why is he getting so worked up over this? It's a pretty simple notion. Part of the answer is caffeine. The second part of the answer is because this really, really matters in terms of redemption. Okay, here's why. I'm going to try to do this, unfortunately, a little bit far too quickly, but we'll try to extend our time a little bit here. Okay, but you're going to like this, Chris. Okay. That's right, yeah. Which you don't, but go ahead. No, totally kidding. Totally kidding. You want to know how I define, you know what I know how I define ethnicity or race? It's actually otherness, yeah. Reified. I mean, that's just for you, because we were talking about this earlier, so it's kind of an interesting concept. Yes?
All of this fits into what you said in lecture two, that everything is worship and worship is everything.
Yeah.
And it just fits right in.
Yeah. Thanks for noticing that. Yeah, I mean, that really is building up to this. So, yeah, and then hopefully we'll tie it into 2 weeks from now on redemption. That's ultimately where we want to end up. But, yeah, thanks for noticing that. So let me just give you a couple quick examples. I think, Chris, you're right on there with me because this is my heartbeat. But I think that the process of reification, fancy term, but we all know what it means now, right? That whole process, which sociologists have studied and really kind of mastered in the past 30 years, that process, if anywhere, is very clear. It tends to be in media. And it tends to, I think, especially in emotionally charged media, okay? So I can only do best, I think, by pointing to examples. So let me just point to a couple examples where reification has taken place and then try to unpack it just a little bit further. But again, forgive me for the quickness here. I think you guys are all tracking great, so this is awesome. But let me just give you the example, and I'll only play part of it, and then we'll play two other examples of what I'm talking about here. So,
okay. Closed off from love, I didn't need the pain. Once or twice was enough, and it was all in vain. Time starts to pass before you know it, you're frozen.
Anyone familiar with this tune from about, say, like 10, 15 years ago?
But something happened for the very first time with you. My heart melted to the ground, found something true. And everyone's looking round, thinking I'm going crazy.
You guys get the idea. The song from Leona Lewis is about maybe 12, 15 years old. She says in one part, as you just read, my heart's crippled by the vein you keep on closing, right? So what's the idea here? To me, it's actually quite simple. There's three R's that I often talk to my students about. What I think happened here is I don't think Leona Lewis decided to go to the studio one day, write a song, and then after writing that song, she created by herself the subculture of cutting. Like, I don't think that's way too simplistic an analysis. She did not write that song and all of a sudden teenagers all over the world are cutting themselves. That's too simplistic. Rather, I think what she's done is, or probably more likely someone who she's hired has done, she goes out and see what's already going on in certain parts of youth culture. They see the values that they exhibit. And then they just simply decide to write a song that resonates with what's already going on. So the first R is she reflects the values already out in public. But here's what she does. When she does write that song, and then it gets played on the radio airwaves over and over again, the second thing is now it's not just a mere, oh, I'm just reflecting what's already out there. Hold on a second. Now you're actually kind of responsible because you are reinforcing those same values that you were just reflecting a minute ago. Right? So you're going from reflection of those public values to a reinforcement of those public values. And the third and most important thing that goes on is it finally turns into, well, if I break up with my boyfriend and I'm really upset with my parents, yeah, I'm just going to turn to cutting myself. It's reified. That instinctual value of like, yeah, I'm going to cut myself because that's what we do when we are feeling this angst. I can share with you a very brief story of how true this came home to me when I was giving a talk at a church building on some of this material, and one of the moms afterwards came up to me and said, you wouldn't believe how true this whole, you know, reflection, reinforcement, my daughter, at the time she was in 10th grade, she said, was part of that kind of goth, emo-ish culture, and was kind of found her kind of with these tendencies to want to cut, and so she couldn't understand it, you know, it was a very loving, supportive household. She brought them to Christian counselors. They couldn't explain why. She had no symptoms, you know, of clinical anything. That happened for several months. And all of a sudden, I think it was between the summer of 10th and 11th grade, all of a sudden, completely, as if overnight, she just stopped, right? And I asked her, so I asked the mom, you know, so what do you account for this? And she said, actually, she just shifted friends. She had a new set of friends. Going to a new, and so that's how powerful this understanding of reification can serve us as we think about what we need to be doing. So this is why, when Eddie says it, I totally believe it. We need to have great people in the graphic arts industry. I think I shared with you guys that I started a t-shirt clothing company just because I didn't like seeing skulls and bones everywhere. Like sometimes there's something interesting about that, but I like graphic art that's going to reflect goodness, truth, and beauty. And that's why we need to have really strong Christians in the graphic design world, in the video game world, in the movie making world, right? So I think we're building on this sociological notion of reification. So social theory is actually very important to our theology. And to couple that with the theology that we are looking at as well, we need to do this together. That's what I think will bring us to true analysis and activism we constantly talk about in this class, right? So let me go very briefly then over controls aren't working very well here. Okay, I'll play the first 3 seconds. You'll notice the tune. Some of you guys are very familiar with this song, because it's played constantly over the radio, right? For a second time, I'm not going to... Stop. Okay, I won't even play the song, but very, very... briefly, I'll explain it to you. What does the song say? If you listen closely to the lyrics, it's simply saying, I'm trying to do an analysis on this, but I think it's something simply along the lines of, okay, so the whole chorus, right? The constant refrain of the song is, don't tell them, don't tell them. You ain't even got to tell them, don't tell them, don't tell them. Don't, you good. That's there. You've reified, you okay, good. So the don't tell them, I mean, very simply, it's a song about cheating, right? Like, this is between us, you don't have to tell them, right? Now, you've got, you know, anywhere from 5-year-olds to 15-year-olds and, you know, the rest of us listening to this song, and you're, again, Jeremiah, I think they say pronounce the same, you first reflect, then reinforce, but you actually are complicit in this. You're actually reifying those values, right? So what's the response to this? One is to analyze the thing like we're trying to do here. Secondly is the activism. I think we root, because we're asking about Christian rap earlier, or rap that happens to be Christian, so to speak. That's how Lecrae defines it. But he has a really good counter-reification, if you will, to this. So here's, very briefly.
Hey, fellas.
Interesting little narrative in the beginning.
Oh, they're right there in the back.
Okay, so what's going on here is Lecrae,
I can't lie, I admire beauty like the next man. I still remember when I used to get my check cash, get my hair cut, I hit the streets with my head gas, looking out for little mamas with a fat fast. That's what my auntie used to tell me, my girl in my rear view trying to tell me, cause she knew it wasn't nothing you could tell me, always on the trail of another female. Well, they say my papa was a player, so my dishonesty is honest in me, baby. Somehow in college Greek letters made me cuter all the time online, I still couldn't compute it. I pledged girls, then it's on to the next girl. My next girl eventually be my ex-girl. But it's funny how it all unfolds. I done finally found a woman I ain't never let go.
Words, if she looking back, don't do it. I wonder if she got a man, don't do it. I don't see no wedding band, don't do it. I promise you don't wanna go through it. Look, take it from me, you don't wanna follow.
Okay, so I think the point is made, right? What I particularly appreciate about Lecrae is that he actually doesn't call himself a Christian rapper. He calls himself a rapper who is also Christian. Now, there's a distinction. He's saying, I want to make really good art because I think God is glorified by just making really good art in music. But it certainly will be the case that a lot of my song will have a very strong either undertone or a very explicit overtone about my faith, right? And so he makes this song, I think, not as a reaction to Jeremiah's song, but thankfully he does write a song that's actually quite interestingly similar, right? So don't tell him. But Lecrae is saying, look, here's a way to live a life that's actually better. Don't do it, right? And so I think we have to kind of broaden our apologetic to take note of a couple things, one of which is analysis, which we're doing here. We're trying to bring social theory into our theology and use both so we can really understand God's world and the way it works, right? And wherever truth may be found, as we saw from Augustine 2 weeks ago, it belongs to its master. So if it's found in social theory, hey, let's take that truth and apply it and use it for the kingdom, okay? And then the second thing, of course, as we always couple it with, is activism. I think we need to raise a generation of Lecrae's, as it were. Yes, we need to raise a generation of lawyers, doctors, other professionals, but we also want to encourage this in our children to say, hey, this is actually a really worthwhile, godly kingdom vocation. And it's just so beautiful that it turns out that Lecrae, you know, did win a few Grammys. I mean, it's great when they win Dove Awards, but it's even better, I think, when they win Grammys, right? Because now you've won. So it's not different from what we read in, I believe, Proverbs 22:29, if that's right, where again, if you see a man or woman skilled in his work, right, he or she will stand before kings. It's just it's a moral principle of the universe. It just operates that way. We're not trying to get in front of Obama to give him a stage, you know, give ourselves a stage to maybe preach the gospel, although that would be great. But if you are skilled in your work, whatever that work may be, you will stand before kings. It's how the universe is set up, right? So I think we need to appreciate that proverb and hone our craft. Fides. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, so actually, I think chronologically, I think they came out almost exactly the same time. So unless they were reading each other's notes, maybe they were. I don't think that actually happened. But it turns out, I mean, they both came out last year, I think. Oh, wait, I think the previous song came out a year before. So maybe you're right. Maybe Lecrae was responding to Jeremiah. That would be fun to see. Yeah. But again, that is one aspect of our work of redemption. But another aspect, right, is not to necessarily pit them as our enemy. Because remember, at the end of the day, as Augustine and Jesus himself says, it's wheat and tares. And so it's a mixed bag, so to speak. And we can't just completely say, oh, you're completely evil because you're not Christian. I'm completely pure because I am Christian. We have to be careful not to do that. And I'm saying that to say this. We have to also reach out to the people and not just completely demonize them, so to speak, right? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Be at peace with them. That's what Paul writes. Yeah. Yeah. So that's good. I think that's right. So the reason I'm saying that is because, look, let's just take the example of Lucrece staying with him. It just so happens that he happened to make really good friends with this other guy named Kendrick Lamar. Kendrick Lamar. I mean, I'm trying to use names that you might recognize, so like Tupac, Snoop Dogg, back in the, you know, kind of this hip hop world, right? Or James Taylor, who eventually, am I right on that? James Taylor eventually became Christian. Okay. Anyways, the point is, who is that? Okay, yeah, there's an example, right? So Kendrick Lamar is like probably globally, because hip hop is a global phenomenon, is probably the most, you know, admired artist in hip hop among the youth, you know, at least for the past couple of years. Well, it just so happened that Lecrae struck up a good friendship with him, and they began featuring each other on each other's album. And eventually, Kendrick Lamar, just about over a year ago, became a baptized believer, right? And so again, let's not demonize. I know that's what you were doing, but it's this idea of, yeah, let's outcompete in a sense, make the best art possible, but let's also reach out to those folks who we think are not saved and do that as well. It's never one or the other. I think it's both. Yeah. Dr. John. Yeah, the contradict, coexist, contradict. Yeah. What about it? Sorry. Right. Yeah, so that's I think there's an interesting thing going on there, which is simply a response to the coexist bumper sticker. It may go too far because it's just the one word. Do they contradict on every single point that they affirm? No. I think they both all probably affirm 2 + 2 = 4. Oh, gosh, yeah. Mm-hmm. All truths lead to one place. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think... Oh, sorry, Chris, go ahead. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Roddy, and then... Or... There you go.
About 35 years ago, when heavy metal was... like rapid...
Yeah.
That was a Christian...
Yeah.
S-T-R-Y-P-R.
I know them.
Their big song was "To Hell with the Devil."
Is that it? Or was there more? Did you want to say something about that?
Well, I'd sing it for you.
Okay. Okay. Last word. That's right. I think we need to bring goodness, truth, and beauty to the whole of God's creation. Recover the goodness, truth, and beauty. That's right. Yeah. Well put. Okay. Well, thanks for that, you guys. So what we're going to do is really try to capitalize on the things we were learning tonight and reconvene in 2 weeks' time. Do, if you remember, pray for me for safe travels. I'll be on the other side of the planet in Hong Kong. But yeah, why don't I have one of us volunteer to... Oh, Saturday, just for a week. So I'll be... That's why I have to miss next Thursday. But I'll come back on Friday. So as we're mentioning, Jacob will take care of the summary of the worldview topics that we've been discussing so far. And he's following pretty closely the notes that you do have. I told him, you know, feel free to modify a bit here and there. I think that's only fair. But he's got the notes, just like Eddie has had, and they read through them. But you have them as well. So. Yeah, exactly. Nice. Great. So could I just ask someone to pray for us, and then we can, you know, chat a little bit here if you want afterwards. Thanks, Jim. Amen. Thanks, guys. All right.